Well, we made it up to slide 9. And slide 9 gives you a good view of something I talked about in the last chapter, actually, the movement of membrane material from organelle to organelle. It's good to get a picture. So, for instance, you see membrane that used to be rough ER budding off as vesicles containing the modified proteins. That membrane then becomes part of the Golgi membrane when the vesicle fuses with the which end of the Golgi? The cis end, the receiving end. And then new vesicles bud off of the trans face, the other end of the Golgi. So that's more movement of membrane. And then next moment, the membrane is part of the plasma membrane. What process is this, by the way, when it's binding to the plasma membrane? Right, this is exocytosis, vesicular transport that moves something out of the cell. Another thing I wanted to say about this picture, though, is that notice that some of these proteins in the vesicle are fully inside the vesicle, and some of them, or at least this one, is embedded in the vesicle membrane. The reason that makes a difference is that when this vesicle binds to the plasma membrane and becomes part of the plasma membrane, the proteins that were fully inside the vesicle get fully exported out of the cell. But that one that was part of the membrane of the vesicle is now part of the plasma membrane. This is how a cell adjusts what proteins are embedded in its membrane. It can put them in via this method, or it can endocytotically bring some membrane out of the plasma membrane and therefore take those proteins out. The next three slides, 10, 11, and 12, I'm going to talk about downstairs. It's still part of the material you need to know, but I'm not going to do it up here. So that brings us to 13. And we're looking at a unicellular organism here. More specifically, this is a protist. Have I told you what a protist is in general? Have I used this word before? A protist is kind of an informal grouping of organisms. A protist is any eukaryotic organism that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So animals are eukaryotes. I mean, they're in the domain eukarya. Plants are, so are fungi. And then there's a bunch of other groups that are also in eukarya, and we lump them all together by using the word protist. Some of them are unicellular, like this one. They don't have to be. There are some very huge protists. Algae are protists, and there are some brown algae in the ocean that are as big as trees. But this one is a unicellular protist. And as far as its lifestyle is concerned, it is aquatic. Now, what does that word specifically refer to? Aquatic means that it lives in water, but so does the word marine. What is the difference between aquatic and marine?
Freshwater.
Right. An aquatic organism lives in freshwater, lakes, rivers, whatever. Whereas marine means they live in the ocean, salt water. And that's a totally different environment, right, with respect to, with respect to something we'll talk about downstairs. But anyway, this is an aquatic protist. And that means that, for reasons that I'll explain later today, water, the environment is more watery than the cell, so water is always coming into the cell. And unlike a plant or a bacterium or a fungus, this cell does not have a cell wall. It's like our own cells. It has a plasma membrane, of course, like all cells do, but that's it. It doesn't have a tough exterior that holds in pressure. And therefore, this continuous tendency for water to come into the cell from the environment means this cell would explode. It's under threat of being exploded. Well, the same thing can happen, for instance, to your own cells, like a red blood cell. I'll use an example in the slides I just skipped temporarily. If you lose a red blood cell, no big deal. You can lose a million red blood cells, no big deal at all, because we have so many cells, we're multicellular organisms. But if you're a unicellular organism and you lose a cell, you're dead. That's the entire organism. So the reason this aquatic protist is able to remain in an environment facing continuous influx of water is that it has a special membrane-bounded organelle shown in the circle here called a contractile vacuole. So it's made out of membrane material, just like all the other membrane-bounded organelles, but it also has the same kinds of proteins that are in our muscles, allowing the vacuole itself to contract, just like our heart contracts, to squeeze blood from one chamber to another. What happens is that when the water comes into the cell, the water also goes into the vacuole. And so it gradually gets bigger and bigger. When it stretches enough, that will trigger it into contracting. And it'll just continuously, as it fills, empty itself, pumping the water back out. All right, 14. Now I want to talk more specifically about membrane-bound proteins. We looked at six major functions in a slide last time that membrane-bound proteins can perform. Any given individual protein just has a specific function. It's not doing all six of those major things we discussed. But I want to focus now on transport proteins, which is just one of those six major functions. Transport proteins are indispensable because of what I've told you earlier about the fact that a cell can't have a plasma membrane made entirely from phospholipids. And that's because some things can get through phospholipid bilayers easily, but others can't. And some of those things that can't are things that the cell has to be able to get into or out of itself. That requires the help of transport proteins, which are not only membrane-bound proteins, but because they're involved in getting things either into or out of the cell all the way through the membrane, in other words, they have to be transmembrane proteins specifically, which is, remember, that's a specific kind of integral protein. Well, as far as how they work, transport proteins come in two categories, which is what are shown here. Channel proteins and carrier proteins. Channel proteins have a shape that gives them a hollow interior, so they form just little tunnels. And a little tunnel will allow the correct kind of things. It won't allow just anything through it. It has to be the right kind of particle that can get through it. But it's an open tunnel. And therefore, things can move in either direction through it if they're the right kind. What is it that's going to determine the direction? I mean, what it is that's going to determine the direction is the gradient, which is something else I'm going to talk much more about downstairs. But a gradient is a difference in some value measured at two different places. There's all kinds of gradients, but the gradient that we're talking about here is a concentration gradient. If you have a higher concentration on one side of the membrane than the other, then that's what's going to determine the direction in which the particles go through the channel. You know, similarly, if you have a barrel full of water and you poke a hole through it, you're making a channel in the side of the barrel, the water is going to come out because of its, there's a pressure gradient in that case. It's not going to go in, it's going to go out. Even though water can travel either way through that hole, it's going to, the direction is going to be determined by the gradient. Okay, so that's a channel protein. That they're basically just tunnels, and the protein, without the protein there would be no tunnel, but the protein isn't changing shape in order to allow anything through it. On the other hand, the other category, a carrier protein, gets its name because it does change shape. It carries something across the membrane from one side to the other. And it can also work in either direction, either bringing things in or bringing things out. But that won't happen unless the right kind of particle, and there are carrier proteins that are specific for different kinds of particles. This one happens to be specific for whatever these yellow spheres represent. For the carrier protein to operate, the particle has to temporarily bind to the carrier protein. So this is another example of what? What are the particles acting as in this example? What's the general name for something that binds to a protein?
Ligand.
A ligand, exactly. So this is another example of a ligand, like a signal or a substrate to an enzyme, signal to a receptor. Those are other examples. Here you have a solute particle of some type that temporarily binds to a protein. Well, the reason I mentioned that it's a ligand is because it has the same general consequence. What is the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein? No, this is not acting as a chemical signal. That's just another example of a ligand. But what I'm saying, what happens in all cases of a ligand binding to a protein?
Changes the shape.
Exactly. And what's another name for the shape of a protein?
Conformation.
The conformation, right. When a ligand binds to a protein, there is a conformational change in the protein. And you can that's how carrier proteins operate. They operate by changing shape in response to a specific kind of particle binding to them, and the shape change is such, as you see in this cartoon version, that it picks up the particle on one side and drops it off on the other. Okay, that's a carrier protein. So any given transport protein is either a carrier protein or a channel protein. Okay, now in 15, I need to give you some more definitions, and we'll talk further about this downstairs today. But I already, I think, told you that in terms of mechanisms for getting things into or out of cells, there are three transport mechanisms. Did I tell you this? Well, we've already studied one of the three categories, which is vesicular transport. That's one of the three ways in which cells can get things into or out of them. Okay, vesicular transport is quite a bit different from the other two categories that I'll talk about, because it's kind of a cheating mechanism in a sense, because in vesicular transport, whatever it is that's going into or out of the cell doesn't actually go through a membrane, right? If it's endocytosis, the thing's outside first. The plasma membrane wraps around it to form a vesicle. Now it's inside the vesicle, inside the cell, but it never went through a membrane. Same way with exocytosis. It's not actually going through a membrane. The other two categories, though, of transport mechanisms do involve things going through the membrane. And those other two categories are active transport and passive transport. The big difference here, what distinguishes them, in other words, is the requirement, how much energy is required. Passive transport does require energy. So if you've learned about passive transport before and someone told you that passive transport doesn't require energy, that's false. Passive transport does require energy, but the energy is built into the system in the form of a gradient. Active transport, on the other hand, requires expenditure of an external source of energy. You have to supply external energy, or active transport will never happen. All right? Well, actually, before I even get to this picture, let me just go back to 14 for a second. When you think about these two categories of transport proteins I just talked about, I want you to make sense that a channel protein can... Well, there's one more thing about active transport I need to tell you for this to make sense. Active transport can move things against their gradient. Particles on their own move down a concentration gradient. They always move from where there's a higher concentration to where there's a lower concentration. In other words, they spread out. And the gradient actually powers that. But active transport is able to move things against their gradient. In other words, take them from where there's already a lower concentration and put them to where there's already a higher concentration. In other words, stockpile them. That can never happen on its own, active transport. You have to supply external energy in order to force that to happen. But now what I was trying to say about these two categories of transport proteins is that a channel protein, since it's just an open hole basically, can only ever be used for passive transport. Just like if you do put a hole in the barrel, water is never going to go in. It's only going to go down its gradient, in that case a pressure gradient, from inside to outside. Or if you have an empty barrel and you submerge it in water and you have a hole in it, water's only going to go into the barrel, right? You can't... And that's because it's just an open hole. There's no way to grab on and force it in the opposite direction from what it wants to move in. A carrier protein, on the other hand, actually does latch on temporarily to the particle that's being transported. So a carrier protein can be used for either passive transport or active transport. If it's passive transport that a carrier protein is operating for, then the direction is purely determined by the gradient. So in this case, these particles are coming in passively because they're going down their gradient from where it's higher concentration to where it's lower concentration. And that's what allows that to happen. It happens without any further expenditure of energy. The energy source is the gradient itself. Okay? But sometimes a carrier protein can be used to grab on to something where it's low concentration and force it against its gradient to where it's higher concentration. And you have to force that to happen by supplying energy. Often that energy is in the form of ATP, but it has to be some form of energy. And when a carrier protein is used for active transport, then we call that transport protein a pump. Just like a pump forces things against their gradient, you know, a water pump, for instance, will pump water uphill. It wants to fall down. You force it up by supplying energy. So not all carrier proteins are pumps, but the ones that work for active transport are called pumps. And slide 15 is an example of a pump that we animals have. There are quadrillions of these things in your body. This is called the sodium-potassium exchange pump. And it's the primary kind of pump, not the only kind, but it's the primary kind of pump for animals. It's called the sodium-potassium exchange pump because it's really two pumps in one. So it's an active transport protein that actively transports sodium, but it also actively transports sodium ions, I should say, Na+. But it also actively transports potassium ions. So it's two pumps in one, really. And notice how these numbers are. If for some reason it goes 1, 2, 3, and then down 4, 5, 6 in the reverse direction. But I guess it makes sense because it's a cycle. But what I should tell you is that the normal conditions in your body is that intracellular fluid, the stuff inside the cells, has a higher concentration of potassium ions than the extracellular fluid does. And it's just the opposite for sodium ions. The extracellular fluid has a higher sodium ion concentration than the intracellular fluid. All right, now, what happens here, and you don't really see these concentrations because they're only showing a few ions, but you have to picture there already being a lot of potassium, K plus, inside, not so much outside, and already a lot of sodium outside and not so much inside. That means sodium actually would like to come in, right? And potassium would like to leave because they both want to go down their gradient. But the pump is, the reason it's called a pump is because it's forcing both of these kind of ions in the opposite direction from what it wants to move. So you have a few sodium ions binding to this, to the binding sites on the pump. And of course, that's a ligand again, so it causes a conformational change. But ATP is involved here. ATP is the external source of energy, which you always have to have for a pump. And when ATP gets spent, it's really losing one of its phosphates, and that turns it into ADP, which is not shown here. But that's the expenditure of energy. And that's what forces sodium to the other side, where there's already a lot of sodium ions. It makes the gradient even steeper. All right? And then that will open it to the outside, which allows potassium ions from the outside, and there's not all that many there, to come in and bind. And the phosphate that was left by the ATP previously pops off and allows this thing to spring back into its original shape, dropping the potassiums off to the inside where there's already a high concentration. Now it's an even higher concentration. And this can just keep going over and over as long as you have ATP to spend. Well, these things are, there's so many of these things in your body and they're continuously using energy in the form of ATP that by some estimates it accounts for 40% of your energy budget. 40% of why you have to eat just goes into continuously powering these pumps. And the reason that they're so valuable is that when you make those gradients for these two ions, that allows those gradients to do some work for you. There's all kinds of other things that can happen only if these gradients are in place. And by the way, the gradients are in place. The reason that there's high sodium outside and low inside is because these pumps have made that gradient by stockpiling the sodiums outside and made an oppositely directed gradient for potassium by stockpiling the potassium inside the cells. As long as they're continuing to run, the gradients will still be there. If you turn the pumps off, then the gradients will dissipate, but the cell would not be able to operate in that case. Okay, so that's active transport at work. Now, in 16... we compare passive and active transport based on the kinds of the categories of transport proteins involved. I've already told you this, but now we have a better picture. Passive transport is simply diffusion. And I'll talk a lot more about diffusion downstairs today. But diffusion is passive transport. They're kind of interchangeable terms. Passive transport doesn't even actually always require a transport protein. Depends on the particle. Some particles are easily able to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. So what makes a particle able to are two things. That particle, in order to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, the particle has to be small enough, first of all. If it's too big, it's just not going to be able to get directly through. So that's one requirement, but that's not sufficient. It's not enough. It has to at least be small enough. But think about hydrogen ions, otherwise known as a proton, right? H+. That's really small. It's not even as big as an atom. Still, though, a hydrogen ion doesn't easily get through, even though it is small. What is it about a hydrogen ion that doesn't allow it to get through? Well, what can you say about a hydrogen ion? As a particle. It's beyond polar. It's charged, right? It's fully charged. It's an ion. And charged things do not want to be around these nonpolar tails in the thickness of the membrane. So, this is a pretty good barrier. The phospholipid bilayer by itself is a good barrier against transport of ions into an atom. So that's why the second requirement for a particle being able to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer is that it has to be nonpolar. So if it's nonpolar and big, it can't get through. If it's polar and small, it can't get through. But if it's nonpolar and small, then it can get right through. And in that case, it will simply diffuse either into or out of the cell, depending on what the direction of the concentration gradient. Here you can see that the gradient is such that there's a higher concentration outside than inside, and that's why it's coming in. If it were the reverse situation, it would diffuse out of the cell, but without the help of any protein. Okay? All the other things, meaning the things that are either too big or too polar or both, require the help of a transport protein to, even though they are diffusing, which is a passive process. And depending on the particle, it could use either a channel protein to do that or a carrier protein. But if it's diffusion, which is always passive, then what is powering it is the gradient. They're simply going down their gradient. And so all three of these examples are diffusion, which is passive transport. But when diffusion requires the help of a transport protein, like in these two examples of the left picture, then yes, it is still diffusion, but we specifically call it facilitated diffusion. It's diffusion that is facilitated or helped by a protein so that it can get through the membrane. All right, no requirement of additional outside energy for passive transport. But what I was saying earlier is that a channel protein can only act for passive transport because it's just a gaping hole, basically. For active transport, you have to use a protein, first of all. You can't be just directly through the phospholipid bilayer. And you have to have a carrier protein because it has to latch on to that thing and drag it in opposite way it wants to move. Plus, you have to, of course, supply an external source of energy. This shows ATP, and like I said, that's often the source, but it doesn't have to be. There has to be some external source of energy supplied, though, to force active transport to happen. All right, let's look at an example of active transport. We already looked at one example, which was the sodium-potassium exchange pump. Here we're looking at a different kind of pump, and when, like I said, whenever you see the word pump, you know that it's not just a transport protein, but one that is working for active transport. This is a proton pump, and we have plenty of these in our own body as well, especially in the kidneys. But these are all over in plants. Plants don't use sodium-potassium exchange pumps like we animals do. They have mostly proton pumps. We have both. But anyway, a proton, always remember, is just one of three names. H plus, proton, and hydrogen ion all mean the same thing. Okay, so this is active transport of hydrogen ions, or protons, using a proton pump, and this is powered by ATP. You can see that it's pumping because there is a much lower hydrogen ion concentration inside the cell, and it's pumping it outward where there's already a much higher hydrogen ion concentration. This is usually simply called active transport, but I'm going to call it primary active transport just to distinguish it from what we're going to look at in the next slide, which is called secondary active transport. All right, this is primary active transport, though, and the reason that there is a hydrogen ion concentration gradient here, the reason that there is a higher concentration outside than there is inside, is because this pump created that gradient. Pumps create and maintain concentration gradients. Okay, now, the goal here is, if you think of this in terms of goals, what the plant is trying to accomplish here is not just to get rid of hydrogen ions. That's not why they're being pumped. They're being pumped to create this gradient. And a very important thing to keep in mind about gradients that I'm only mentioning for the first time today, but I'm going to repeat it a lot of times, this term, especially in the next unit after the test, is that any gradient, whether it's concentration gradient or any other kind of gradient, is a form of potential energy, which means that a gradient is useful. If it's set up properly, it can be used to do some sort of work. That's why the plant's doing this, to establish the proton gradient, which can then be used to do something else. That's 17. Let's go to 18 now. This proton pump on the top is just the one we looked at in the previous slide. It's not the only thing embedded in the membrane, though. Right next door in this picture, you have a different protein embedded in the membrane, and it is a different kind of transporter, a sucrose proton co-transporter. I need to, before I go on, let me give you a couple more definitions. Transport proteins come in different categories based on what they transport. We've already talked about categories based on how they operate. They can also be categorized based on what specifically they do transport, allow into or out of the cell. And the proton pump here is an example of a uniporter. Uni, of course, meaning one. A uniporter is a transport protein that will transport just one kind of particle. Now, it can transport many of them, but it's always the same kind of particle. The process could be called uniport. The thing doing it, the protein itself, is called a uniporter. Not all transport proteins do that, though. I've already given you an example, right? Sodium-potassium exchange pump doesn't just transport one kind of thing. It's two. So there are also co-transporters. Co means share. So two different kinds of particles share the same transporter, and they both get moved by that transporter. But there are, that's a kind of a general word because it doesn't tell you anything about the directions, right? There are two different ways co-transporters can work. One way is that both of the two different kinds of particles get moved in the same direction as each other. The only other possibility is that they move in opposite directions with respect to each other. Okay, they both use a co-transporter, but since those are different conditions, we give them different names. And if they move in the same direction, or if the two particles types move in the same direction through the transporter, We call the transporter a symporter, and the process would be called symport. Sim means together. The other possibility, though, is that they move in opposite directions, and if that's true, then the transporter is called an antiporter, and the process would be called antiport. Okay. Well, what kind of co-transporter are we looking at here for sucrose proton? That is a symporter, exactly, because notice by the red arrows that both of these two different kinds of particles are moving in the same direction. So it doesn't matter at all whether they're both moved in or they're both moved out. The fact is they're moving in the same direction as each other. Okay, now, remember I called what's happening on the proton pump primary active transport, which we usually would just call active transport. The reason that that is called primary active transport is that the external energy source, which is always required for any pump, is spent directly at that pump. This ATP is directly powering this proton pump. Okay? Notice that there is no ATP being spent on this sucrose proton co-transporter, but even though co-transporters don't have to be pumps, this one is. How do I know that it's a pump? Well, actually, the way they've drawn the figure, you don't know that from this, because there's only one sucrose outside and one sucrose inside. But the actual real condition is that there's already a high concentration of sucrose inside and a low concentration of sucrose outside. But that would mean, just based on the concentration gradient, sucrose would like to leave the cell going down its gradient. But sucrose is being pumped into the cell, therefore this is a pump. And like I just said multiple times, a pump has to, if it's working for active transport, which a pump always is, it has to use an external source of energy. That external source of energy, though, is not ATP. The external source of energy to power this co-transporter pump is the proton gradient that was created by the proton pump. All right, so this is an example of how creating an ion gradient by pumping ions, using the ATP directly to do that, establishes the gradient. That gradient can pay off in terms of something. In this case, what happens is that there's a high concentration of hydrogen ions outside the cell because of the pump. Therefore, these protons want to go down their gradient. In other words, they want to go back into the cell. They always want to go to where there's a lower concentration. But they're hydrogen ions, they're fully charged, therefore they can't get directly through the membrane, the phospholipid bilayer of the membrane. And it just so happens that the only place that they are allowed to get back in is through this sucrose proton co-transporter. So the hydrogen ions bind temporarily to the co-transporter, but they are diffusing, protons are diffusing passively, right? They're going down their gradient into the cell. But when that happens, the sucrose gets picked up and forced against its gradient along for the ride. So it's sucrose that's being pumped, but the source of energy to allow that to happen is the diffusion of hydrogen ions because of the hydrogen ion gradient that the other pump established. That's why the pumping of sucrose using this co-transporter is an example of what we call secondary active transport. It's not that there isn't any energy spent, it's that the energy is in the form of a gradient that a previous pump had established. So this is using ATP indirectly to pump sucrose, right? You use it directly to establish the gradient, and then you use the gradient of protons to pump the sucrose. Does all that make sense? Okay, good. Well, then we're on 19, and I think that's the last slide for the chapter. This is just another look at, or better look, at vesicular transport. So keep in mind, that's one of the three categories of transport mechanisms that bring things either into or take them out of cells. Those three are active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. This is vesicular transport, and what are the two kinds of vesicular transport based only on the direction of particle travel? Endocytosis and exocytosis, correct. Endocytosis simply means that it's inward vesicular transport. It doesn't tell you at all what is being transported. Exocytosis is outward vesicular transport. But endocytosis is divided into phagocytosis, or cell eating, because what's being endocytosed is solid chunks of something from the environment, like the brown thing here. So this is phagocytosis. And the other kind of endocytosis is pinocytosis, which happens in a lot of cells. They basically are just taking little sips of the fluid exterior, like you see here. These aren't solid chunks. It's the same process. You still use plasma membrane invagination or infolding to create the vesicle to bring the stuff in. And notice these things never actually crossed a membrane. That's true of vesicular transport in general. So though that shows you phagocytosis, pinocytosis. A little bit more complicated thing, though, here is receptor-mediated endocytosis. So there are some cells that are just more or less continuously undergoing pinocytosis, kind of like casting out a line, not knowing whether anything's there or not, just reeling it in over and over. But receptor-mediated endocytosis is a little bit more efficient in a sense, because the vesicle will not form until the cell is sure that the thing that it actually wants to bring in is out there. So this involves these Y-shaped red things, which are proteins. These are receptors. Receptors in general are specific for a certain shape that they recognize, just like antibodies. Only this one's actually specific for the pink triangles, whatever they are. Well, unless that pink triangle is there, nothing will happen, because the pink triangle is another example of a ligand. If there is no binding to the receptor does not change shape, and therefore the cell realizes nothing's out there. But when the receptor does change shape, because that thing is there in the environment, that shape change will tell the cell, make a vesicle, bring this stuff in. Receptor-mediated endocytosis. All right, that's the end of the unit, therefore. So don't forget your Scantron next time, but I'll see you downstairs. Any questions before I turn this off from the unit? Okay.